Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listed on the menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And, of course, we want to wish you a Happy New Year.
And I wish my companion, my co-host, the love of my life, Miss Ann.
Oh, wow.
On our 14th year together and on the menu.
I don't
know how we made it this long, but we hope many of you have come through those 14 years and you're looking forward to the next one. And it turns out we usually go to London in the middle of the year, and somehow or other we never got around to it in 2016. I'm really not sure why.
We were sneaking it in
at the end of the year, and the interviews with the restaurateurs and chefs will be coming starting next week. But in the meantime, it turns out two really excellent books about British food crossed our table. So we thought what a great idea it would be to use them as sort of an introduction to what we're going to be talking about for a few weeks into the new year. But before we do that, one of the things we also do, we don't just eat for a living, do we?
No, we actually do.
We're sort of cultural too, I guess.
Yeah.
And for the last several years, we've been making sure that we caught up with the latest fine art exhibits and other things going on in some of the world-class galleries, which are in London, and some of them are new, some of them are old. Starting out with one that's actually was very, very old because it used to be an electric generating station.
Yeah, I love this.
Called the Bankside, but it became the Tate Modern, a magnificent reuse of a great big box on the riverside on the south side of the Thames, called the Tate Modern, and part of the Tate Gallery collection. And it's got some exhibit spaces that are really quite unbelievable because they're so large. The one I think is called the Turbine Room.
Yes.
And you have to create really big exhibits to put them in there. But it turns out that this year, the exhibit that's there is a very unique collection of photographs collected by the famous British entertainer Sir Elton John, who must like photographs and certainly has money to buy any photograph he might want to have. Now, I discovered something interesting about the Tate as well that I think I shared it with you, but many of you who are in the world of the arts and are interested in that may not even know that the Tate Gallery and all the other galleries, by the way, are free to the public. They're magnificent art collections. The Tate itself, the home Tate Gallery, has a magnificent collection of paintings by Turner. But the reason that they're free to the public is because a company called Tate & Lyle, which had practically a monopoly on sugar and treacle and things like that, based in Liverpool, in Lancashire, in the north of England, actually gave them money for this magnificent set of art museums, including the Tate Modern. And that's something you didn't know. You learned a little something today.
Right. So you can't go into church, but you can go into an art gallery.
There you go. it's actually our first stop. Second up,
the
National Gallery up above Trafalgar Square always has a magnificent exhibition of some kind going on. And this year
is Caravaggio.
Beyond Caravaggio. Yeah, Caravaggio. And Anne's going to have to explain it all to me.
Well, I mean, we didn't see that in Rome. I thought we did.
We saw a Caravaggio exhibit.
But not this one.
But I don't know it. I don't think it's the same one. But it's on very much of a similar theme, and Anne's going to explain. Apparently, this man Caravaggio influenced art for 200 or 300 years after.
I was really interested in Baroque art when I was in graduate school, and this guy was really splendid.
But if you go to the National Gallery, you have to go see the rest of the collection because they have some absolutely magnificent stuff, including an absolutely stunning room filled with Rubens, north, south, east, and west.
That's a great room. I forgot
about
that.
Which is a great room. There are just great rooms everywhere. There's always something going on. And funnily enough, we were talking in last week's program about Sainsbury and then buying bread from Richard Burtonet. It turns out that the Sainsbury family, which still runs the supermarket chain, which has their name, they actually gave enough money for the construction of a whole new wing called the Sainsbury Wing of the National Gallery, and you can spend 2 or 3 days just there.
Yeah, well, and don't miss the Elgin Marbles either.
Oh, well, that's in the British Museum, though.
Oh, I thought it was this
No, it's not in the National Gallery. So,
oh, I thought we were talking about, okay, the National Gallery.
So you can
well, did they have a mummy of a cat? No.
No, that's in the British Museum as well. That's where your cat mummies are. They're impossible. Their fish mummies are there, too.
He laughs at me because I like this cat mummy. I have to see it every time we go there.
So there's lots to see, but hurry over there to see the Caravaggio exhibit, because I think it ends in February, and I think the Sir Elton John one might end at the same time, but I'm not sure.
That's usually what's up next
on you have the master list, the National Portrait Gallery, which is a delightful little gallery that most people miss. It's just around the corner from Trafalgar Square on Charing Cross Road, and they always have excellent exhibitions going on. And this one is a series of portraits by Picasso.
And then
always worth looking at.
The British do incredible things with their fashion celebrities and exhibits of these fashion celebrities.
Yeah, I think the first exhibit of that kind that was really smashing was Alexander McQueen. It was posthumous.
The woman was earlier than that. Vivian, what's her name?
Vivian? There was an Australian singer.
Who?
Is that the one you're thinking of?
Yeah.
I can't remember her name now. Miley Cyrus.
No. Well, anyhow.
I missed that one. Anyway, about 2 years ago, the Barbican, which is an unusually positioned gallery right on the edge of the City of London, rather than in the West End, which is where most of the galleries are located. And we went to see an exhibition of Jean-Paul Gaultier fashions there, including all the wonderful gowns that he made for Madonna. This time they're on the subject of fashion again.
And it has a unique name. It's called the
the it's Vulgar. A little bit of the seamy side of the fashion business, because the exhibit's called The Vulgar.
I love that.
And that one ends in February too. So, that's what we're doing. We're going to be doing, spending some of our time there. And right after the break, we'll be back with more information about
British
food, the British way, restaurants, the London way.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and now on to the culinary scene in London, which is always changing. And you have no idea how much has changed. From when I first went, I always tell the story. I was in England for 2 weeks, and in that 2 weeks, I lost 12 pounds. We were in Whitechapel, right outside of London.
You are on a special British diet.
Exactly. And now the food is spectacular, and you can find just about anything you want in your home. And the whole world there.
And this, we're going to really get nice an overview. This really nice young lady.
Yeah, Alexandra Crapanzano.
Final English name, yes.
Well, she's American anyhow, right? She's American.
Obviously, her ancestry is the same as yours, sweetheart.
Yes, I know that.
It's Italian.
But you'll hear about talking about this. I mean, it was just wonderful being in touch with all their old friends and so forth. It's called the London Cookbook. And you get a tour, you get a direction and guide, and you also get fabulous recipes by these renowned chefs. I don't know when I had more fun reading a cookbook. It's called The London Cookbook by Alexandra Crapanzano. That's Italian, Alexandra?
It is. The last name is Italian, and the first name is Russian, and
right.
I have a middle French name, so I've got a little bit of everything.
Oh. How did that happen?
I think being an American, family from all over the world. My grandfather on my father's side came from Italy to the States to be he was already a doctor, and he came to do his residency in psychiatry and fell in love with my grandmother and stayed in America.
Oh.
And my mother's side of the family were Russian Jews who fled when everybody did and came to Providence, Rhode Island.
Uh-huh.
So,
yes.
So an incredible mix.
Yeah, but you're in love with London and their restaurant scene, and I'm right on the same page with you about that.
I lived in London in 1963. If you'd written this book, then it would have been a very short book.
It would have been a very short book. It would have maybe included one recipe for peach melba from the Savoy and one curry.
And some bangers and mash in there too, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, so much of what I wanted to do with this book is actually very much to chart the progression. And I started going to London in the 80s because I was living in Paris. I was a child. And my mother's best friend was in London and is a Londoner. And I had lived there. I'd lived there when I was a very little child, but I didn't go out to dinner a lot, I don't think. But as a teenager, I would go back and forth quite a lot. And I remember coming from Paris, where my mother, who is a reporter, was living and my father was teaching. We would cross the channel and we would bring so much food with us because we knew the food in London was going to be terrible.
Oh, yes.
And then imagine my incredible surprise when I, you know, after college and graduate school, I went to graduate school actually as a film director and started screenwriting. And I'd always loved the movies that were made in London and in the UK, and I started going back as a screenwriter, and I noticed that the food had gotten so good. And if you, in the 90s, this is, if you really went and found it, but it wasn't, you couldn't kind of eat fabulously across the city yet. And this was kind of late 90s, early aughts. And then when I started really going back, almost, you know, a couple times a year, around 2004, I just noticed an incredible, incredible energy in the culinary scene and new places popping up. And more importantly, almost, I felt that everybody was talking about food.
Right.
And nobody used to talk about food in London. Maybe people would talk about scones or tea or Christmas pudding or the best bangers and mash, but it wasn't, you didn't feel that the city was alight with enthusiasm, and now the city is in a full food frenzy, I feel.
Oh, it's wonderful. We go, as I told you, every year without fail, and I'm going to just sort of sketch out for our listeners your book subtitled Recipes from the Restaurants, Cafes, and Hole-in-the-Wall Gems of a Modern City, but I'm amazed that you got all of these chefs to give you recipes. Explain the concept and how you went around about getting these chefs to give you their recipes.
I absolutely will. And, you know, one of the things when I was looking for a publisher for this book and meeting with editors, all the editors would ask the same questions, which was, you know, chefs are so secretive about their recipes.
Right.
What makes you think they're going to hand them to you? And I said, you know, the kind of cooking that I want to write about is very much cooking that is almost like home cooking. It is the cooking that exists in London today, which is, it's got a little bit of whimsy, it's very international, it's not formal and stuffy, it has really beautiful, bold seasoning and very fresh ingredients, and it is an utter and complete departure from what British food is known to be. But all of these chefs are so fluid. I find that really good chefs, you know, they'll go to the farmer's market, or they'll get their shipment of ingredients in the morning, and there'll be certain techniques that they've all mastered and their sous chefs have mastered and that they kind of stand by. But then they really do love experimenting. So to me, I felt that I would go to these wonderful restaurants and I would sample different things, and then I would really interview the chefs for, you know, oftentimes a cup over a meal or for an hour or two, and very much go into the question of, okay, what if your recipes can be adapted to a home kitchen, and how do we do that, and how do we make it not for 35 people, but what's a good recipe for 6 to 8 people? And what I noticed was that the chefs were not only incredibly excited to be in a book that was celebrating their food and what, and really the fact that London is no longer a city to be derided for its food, but to be loved for its food. So they wanted that word out. But they also liked the idea, I think, of realizing that, you know, that recipes change every day, and that this was a chance to actually see something get put down on paper that they had created. And I think many people actually will end up having these things on their menu.
Because people come looking for them, sure.
Right, because, yes. Yeah. But to answer your question a little bit more succinctly, to me it was never an issue of whether chefs would give me their recipes, because I do feel that they're, especially in London, it's an incredibly generous group of chefs. There's a tremendous solidarity. So many of them have been trained together or worked in the same restaurants, and they really all loved the idea of being included in a book that was celebrating what the city is doing in the food world today.
Now, you had two...
That was fun. And my process, to just quickly answer the second part of your question, was absolutely overwhelming at first, because I was so enthusiastic that I collected about 350 recipes.
Yeah.
And it had to get down to 125, so I tested everything, and I had an intern who'd gone to culinary school also test everything. And then we kind of cut down to around 175, and then cutting the last, you know, 65 recipes was so tough. I wish I could have made it longer.
Well, we'll come back and talk about ones you left. Had to leave out, which you think people ought to know about, and therefore should investigate getting a recipe from somebody
else. I should put them on a website. Yes.
The interesting thing, early in the book, you have a chart. In fact, you have two charts, two charts which show the relationship between the River Cafe.
Well, it's called the London Culinary Tree, and you do Fergus Henderson with St. John, and then you do Ruth Rogers with the River Cafe.
And these are you name just a few of the relationships, and we know there are actually a whole lot more that could be included, because a lot of what's happened in the dining scene that we've talked about, which is now suitably celebrated. It's the work of a handful of chefs who just decided they were going to break out and chef the right way.
I agree. I wanted to do family trees, and I wish I could have done more. I mean, you always have to, you know, the publisher sets a page limit. In this case, it was 308 pages, and I really had to stick to that. But I would have loved to have done a Terence Conran one, for example.
Yeah.
But I wanted to talk about Ruthie Rogers, who is the chef and owner of the River Cafe, and whose late partner, Rose Gray, had she still been alive, I would have absolutely put her right in there, but it felt wrong to do so. But and Fergus Henderson of St. John Food and Wine.
You were
really
so
pioneered.
Sweet. You were so sweet in your comment about him. And everybody knows, of course, that he has Parkinson's. But you put it in writing how you felt about it. And I thought that was... I haven't read that anywhere.
I'm so glad. I felt totally in love with Fergus.
I do, too.
He's a very, very dear man whose spirit is just undiminished.
Yes.
And a very generous man. And what struck me when I first, you know, I realized I wanted to write this book, it came to me after, you know, years of doing my Wall Street Journal column and being so inspired by what was happening in London and often writing about London chefs and cookbook writers, and then really realizing that there was a cookbook to write. But then as a writer, I also wanted a story to tell. And when I started doing research, what I quickly realized was how many of the really amazing young chefs in London all did their stage or worked at one of these two restaurants, if not both.
Uh-huh.
And what struck me about these two restaurants in particular, and about Fergus and Ruth in particular, was that they are both teachers in a way. They're not just chefs, but they're people who by nature make very good mentors. And so what I quickly noticed was that they had beautifully trained many of the great chefs today, but they had also given them their wings, and that those chefs were opening restaurants very clearly showed the incredible craft that they got at St. John or at the River Cafe, but were also very much their own, that were their own taste and style and voice, culinary voice. And that I found fascinating, that these two extraordinary chefs
right.
could also teach and inspire and then send people on their way to do their own thing. That meant a lot to me. And also the family aspect of that, the fact that there were so many people who really had worked together from the time
they relate to each other as family. It's really interesting, actually.
It is really interesting. So just as a writer, what was wonderful, too, is that because they, you know, many of them had been roommates or, you know, for example, Joseph, who's one of the chefs at the River Cafe, had actually been roommates with the chef of Doc Kitchen, who had actually also been roommates with Tomasina Myers, who's a Mexican chef there. So there were these wonderful connections, and people were very happy to pass along emails and introductions. And
this is one of the great things about your book. I mean, you do get these. You have standard, well, not altogether standard, but you divide the book up into chapters according to things like soups and light fare and, you know, meats and whatever. But you have a story with each of these chefs. You invited the chefs to give you the recipes, and you have a very personal note and tone with your writings about each of these chefs that I related to immediately because I know these people. You know,
I'm so glad you said that. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, it's personal. I mean, it's not just anecdotal. It's on a personal, interpersonal level, which I love.
Now that
I'm so glad.
The chart I wish you'd tried to do was Terrence Conran's chart.
Yeah.
I know. You know, Terrence Conran's chart would just be incredible. And obviously, I know Jeremy Lee, who's the incredible chef at Quo Vadis, who had come out of Bibendum. And there's so many people who did. But I do write about him a lot in the introduction, because what Terrence Conran really did, in my opinion, is he really broke the London restaurant world out of the formality that had existed for so long.
Right.
Now, it was really funny, Alexandra. We ate at, he has a, but it's like a restaurant with rooms in the East End somewhere, and I can't remember the name of it now.
Mm-hmm.
And we had dinner there, and the man who was running the place, he said, Terrence gets bored quickly. He said he likes opening restaurants, but he doesn't like running them. And this is the 50th. I think it was called the Standard or something like that.
That makes sense. Meanwhile, he's running an entire empire as
yes.
well.
Coleman Andrews actually in his book on the New British Table, he traces everything back to Conran. But his introduction, I mean, his dedication for his book was to mm-hmm. Terrence, and I forgot to ask him if he meant Terrence Conran.
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I think he must have. No, and I think that, you know, absolutely. I mean, I hope, make it quite clear in the introduction that he had an enormous, enormous influence, not only on food, but I think much more on design. I mean, I do feel that he kind of brought Elizabeth David and that ingredient-driven, beautiful, simple food to London in the 80s. But then I also feel that what the most important and very lasting, I think, legacy was that idea of creating a restaurant that was neither as fancy as the Savoy nor a curry house or a pub that you just kind of stopped into in your work clothes, but was a place that you could go on a weeknight and feel at home and have great food and dress up a little bit maybe, but not feel that you were in a stuffy environment. And I think the timing of what he did very much reflected class changes in London, but also paved the way for somebody like Fergus Henderson to open a restaurant with whitewashed walls and wood tables. And,
yeah, it's really a,
you know,
an awful
lights and,
restaurant.
And
I mean,
nothing too fancy.
Yeah, I mean, it's really a plain Jane restaurant, isn't it?
It is. And yet the food then becomes the star, and people's conversation can be animated because they're not worried about, you know, being overly attended to or messing up anything. and I think these places are so much fun. That's what really struck me too about these restaurants, is that after 1,000 years of not loving eating out, I think what we're seeing is a culture that is suddenly going out and loving it and talking about food. And
you know,
some of that also has to do with people like Jamie Oliver, who on television, I think, really did make cooking sexy and fun. And he, of course, came out of the River Cafe as well.
Mm-hmm.
Nigella Lawson had a huge influence, obviously.
I loved your comments about how she made food sexy in England.
She did. I think that Jamie Oliver just made it very hip to cook, and Nigella just put it into the porn category.
The very first recipe I ever saw on her television show, brown bread pudding.
Oh, there you go. Right.
She got more mileage out of buttering bread.
Buttering brown bread. Well, I have to say, one of the things you asked about the different sections for the book, and one thing I insisted on is having two dessert sections, because not only do I love sweets, but there is, I mean, the British do have a real sweet tooth, and the tradition of tea.
Tell me about it.
It's still there, but actually I feel the desserts have really moved out of tea and into when everybody's now working into their place at the end of dinner. And the recipes in this book for desserts are so good. And some of them are a little bit classic, like the Bakewell tart, or like the some of the puddings, like the ginger rum pudding. But a lot of them are really reflect what's happening in London today, which is a cuisine that is very boldly influenced from other cultures and by other cultures. And so you're seeing rose water used and orange blossom used and much more reliance on ground nuts instead of flowers and spices. And the Christmas pudding in the book is with garam masala instead of the usual flavors. And the custard is a nutmeg custard. Everything has been given a certain vitality that I think is really what's making the food there so good.
Well, there was one I laughed at that was a Christmas pudding made with, Indian ingredients?
Yes, garam masala Christmas pudding, yes, which is wonderful.
That's the one we're just talking about.
It's
beautifully spiced. I mean, it's kind of the best of India and the best of British cuisine combined. And what my intern discovered as we were testing it is that you can also make it in a Pullman loaf pan, in one of those tin bread pans, which are so convenient, that have their own top to them.
Now, there are two things. I didn't read the book from cover to cover, so maybe you have these covered, but two interesting things for listeners to focus on if they're on the subject of your book, but unfortunately maybe they got left out. One is the Michelin-starred Indian and Chinese restaurants in London, and the other, and this is particularly interesting, is the number of people from the British Commonwealth of Nations, like Australia and New Zealand, who went to London just for a bit and finished up staying, like Peter Gordon,
absolutely,
Providores, Shane Osborne, I guess, at Pierre Terre,
and Anna Hansen of the Modern Pantry,
right? She's a key.
Is another one, and Sky Jinjal of Spring,
So you do,
and of course, and you have gave a nice spread to Bruno Labbé, which is like a lot of the French stuff that started making waves.
Absolutely. And there is a wonderful influence of that, I think, and that's, I did want to capture that. I think going back to your other question about Chinese and Indian, there are, I would say that there are quite a lot of really fantastic Indian recipes in this book. Asian recipes are, I find, very tough to do in a book that is
Not
an Asian book, and I really thought about it. Chinese recipes just require a whole different pantry, and I felt that I wanted to keep a little bit more consistent and not go in that direction. But I will say that one of my favorite recipes in the book is a kakuni, which is a Japanese braised pork belly.
Yes, well, that's fabulous.
It's so good. And they're actually, what was wonderful is that Koya and Koya Bar are these two restaurants, or were these two restaurants, right next to each other in Soho, and very small. And Koya actually closed because the wonderful chef who ran it, who was making these beautiful noodles by hand, was also an artist, and he ended up going back to Japan to return to art. But his partner stayed and opened Koya Bar, and so I actually included different braising liquid, one from Koya and one from Koya Bar, and they're both, I think, recipes that I will just return to again and again throughout my life. But they're braised with honey and ginger and hard apple cider and sake and soy sauce and mirin, and they are absolutely, they smell divine, and they're easy to make, and you can serve them over rice for dinner, or in a more traditional Japanese style, just, you know, a kind of piece or two of pork belly in a bowl with chopsticks.
Well, Alexandra, I mean, you and I are obviously kindred spirits and could go along for a few hours. But I wanted to give you one opportunity to close the interview down with how you really wanted people, readers, to be able to use this book.
Absolutely. A great question. To me, this was always going to be a working cookbook. It was always meant to be a cookbook that would capture what's going on in London today in a way that you can make at home. And I would say, with the exception of a Spanish cassoulet, which is a wonderful Spanish rice on the French.
My eye was on that, except for Peter pointed out extensive.
Great recipe. And one Bruno Loubet apple tart, which is slightly more complicated than, let's say, the Fergus Henderson apple and Calvados cake, which is very easy and delicious. Besides those two recipes, everything is something you can make, if not on a weeknight, certainly on a weekend. And some of the recipes take, you know, 20 minutes and are incredibly easy. But what is true about them is that the flavors and the spices and the freshness of the ingredients, I think, are very contemporary. So to me, it's very much a working cookbook, but I desperately hope that everybody will read the text, too.
The stories, yes.
And the story and the introduction, because I think not only did I really spend a lot of time thinking and reading and meeting and talking to people and researching this book, but I do feel that the way that London became a food capital is quite fascinating, and how much of an enormous influence a couple people, even in a very large city, can have in really reshaping the culinary landscape. I would love my readers to take the book to bed and read the introduction, and then I'd like them to bring it to the kitchen and cook from it and make it, you know, cook from it for years, because the recipes, these are not recipes that are particularly faddish in any way. They're going to stay. So that is my hope. And I also feel that by calling it the London Cookbook, which I wanted to do because that is what it is very much, I do want to make sure that people know that it is not the food of yesteryear. It is very much the food of today. It's not a cookbook of British food. It is a cookbook of a very international, very vibrant cuisine.
Well, I'm going to make a projection that if Buckhouse gets a copy of this book, I forecast that you will emerge in the New Year's Honours list with an MBE or something like that.
That would be very fun.
You certainly deserve it, and my nation is grateful for you.
You are so dear to say it. And the book is going to come out with Little Brown in the UK in May. So right now it's available, of course, in the US and all through North America and on Amazon all over the world. But I'm so happy to know also that I have a British publisher.
Alexandra Crampanzano, well done. Good job.
Thank you. It has been such a pleasure talking to you both.
And you too.
Until next time. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, our next guest is a longtime acquaintance, and he's somebody who's a citizen of the world, so he certainly knows his way around the culinary scene of many countries. And in this particular book, he turns his attention to the British table, and he will give you a sense of how it's evolved from when I lost 12 pounds in 2 weeks. So here we are, Coleman Andrews and the British table. This guest, his specialty is making tomes about cooking. And Coleman, how many books do you have now?
Well, I've written 9 books on food. They're not all cookbooks, but they're about food one way or another.
Yeah.
And then I co-wrote and co-edited 3 other ones.
I see. Well, Coleman Andrews, you also have a day job, which is you run the Daily Meal, right?
That's right.
And the current book I'm looking at, which is another doorstopper, it's a big one, is The British Table, A New Look at the Traditional Cooking of England, Scotland, and Wales.
Now, here's the thing, Coleman, because I grew up over there. I grew up in an era when some of these things were still on the table. Some of them had disappeared from the table. But everywhere I went around the world, people laughed at my country's cuisine and said and said it was really awful. It was altogether grey looking. No one in their right mind would want to eat something that was so overcooked. So what possessed you to tackle this that says there's a renaissance now, but that renaissance has its foundations in a past several decades, even several centuries ago?
Well, first of all, from the point of view of deciding to write, having written books on the food of Spain and Italy and so forth, to take what some people would say is a pretty colorless, bland diet, the cooking of Great Britain, this was actually an easy one for me compared to the book I wrote about 5 years ago, which was about Ireland.
Yeah,
and
which is
really
a good book.
That I really got, people really asked me about that, had 150 recipes, and people regularly said, are there 150 recipes in Ireland?
Oh, I love Ireland's food now.
but with England, Scotland, and Wales, and I did not include Northern Ireland in here only because I dealt with it pretty extensively in my book on Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And also, what I didn't know, and I'm sure you know this, but I didn't realize the distinction. We tend to use, in America anyway, the phrases Great Britain, Britain, and the UK interchangeably. But, in fact, Britain is only 2 countries, England and Wales. Great Britain brings Scotland into the mix. And the Scots, of course, like to say, it took Scotland to make Britain great. and then the United Kingdom draws in Northern Ireland, but Northern Ireland is not part of Great Britain. So anyway, this is Great Britain, the three countries of Great Britain.
Because who knows what's going to happen after Brexit?
Of course,
who knows
yes, exactly. Exactly. It'll probably be back to just plain Britain. I don't know. But we'll see. What fascinated me was really 2 things. One thing was I've been going to England, and especially London, but other parts too, for many, many years. I mean, decades and decades. And there really was a very noticeable change that started maybe 25 years ago and really flowered a dozen years ago or so with young chefs really embracing the culinary past of Britain and of course all the wonderful raw materials, great produce and the seafood and the meats and game and everything else. That was one thing that interested me. But then the past also interested me. And when you start, I love reading about things. I love going back to source material and not only historical treatises and nonfiction, but also novels from earlier times often give you a lot of information.
Yeah,
about
you cite a lot of those references in this book, which is especially
well,
the introduction.
I liked your
quotes about curry, wasn't it?
Vanity Fair? A very funny passage in Vanity Fair with Becky Sharp at the dinner table, she's putting on airs and you know trying to be very sophisticated, and they feed her some curry, which kind of sort of blows her head off. And then what really blows her head off is they offer her a chili, and she thinks chili sounds nice and cold, and it will soothe her palate. And of course, it has the opposite effect. It's pretty funny, but there are recipes for curry and curry powder in the 18th century in England and Scotland. There's a wonderful passage from Tobias Smollett, the Scottish author, late 18th century, from one of his novels, which I quote in the book, where a squire is bragging to his doctor about about the way he eats, and it's the ultimate locavore diet. Everything is from his own estate, or he brags about he has any kind of fish or oysters that he wants that are no more than 4 hours out of the water. He has meat from his own animals and game from his own forest, and every fruit that England grows in his garden and all this. And yeah. So he's really, only thing he doesn't have is wine, but he mentions he gets that from someone whose integrity he absolutely trusts. And meanwhile, he makes his own cider and beer from his own hops and his own apples.
Well, there is a tradition, obviously, of some feasting. Before, I think I agree with you that the reign of Victoria kind of put a squash on a lot of stuff. It was all class. I mean, it was all a class experience. I mean, you only ate the way that you write about if you were upper class or aristocracy.
Well, yes and no. That is true as far as the sophisticated food and the wide range of products available.
Right.
And of course, the nobility owned all the game preserves, and poachers were hung if they were found, you know, shooting the king's rabbits or something.
Eating swans. I mean, the queen owns all the swans.
Exactly. That's right. Yeah, which were considered very edible. But even the poorer people, when they were still really tied to the land, there are accounts of rustic banquets where you know it's the village and it's the dance and so forth. What happened besides Queen Victoria and her non pleasure loving court? One of the other things that happened, of course, was the Industrial Revolution, which took people away from the land into the cities and divorced them from the source of a lot of this good food.
Right.
And then World War I came along, and it took all the young men, and it didn't send a lot of them back. And some of the ones that came back were missing an arm or a leg, and they couldn't really work the fields anymore.
I've been reading all these novels. A lot of them ended up in mental hospitals. They had specific mental hospitals for people, for the injured in World War
I. Exactly. Exactly. Anyway, for a number of reasons, what had been really, I mean, there's a historian and food writer named Colin Spencer, and I quote his book on English food, and he said when he started investigating and discovering recipes from Norman England, so we're talking about the 12th century and late 11th century, he said he was stunned at how sophisticated and how modern a lot of their recipes sounded. So
right.
It goes back a long way.
I have one story to tell, even though Peter has a question, is that Hester Blumenthal, who you reference, pub he bought in Bray, doing all these investigations through, what university was it, Rabbit the Ark?
I don't remember.
He thought one of his dishes he thought would have a really long heritage was Plowman's Lunch. And he discovered it was created in the 60s, wasn't it, Rabbit?
It was created in the 1960s to persuade
exactly.
To persuade the guy who was in there for a quickie and had the other half maybe would stay longer if he could eat something And then he could have a whole second pint.
Right, exactly.
So Heston was kind of disappointed to find that out.
Right. Well, I mean, Heston, as you know, not only is one of the most modern contemporary chefs, but he's also a great student and lover of these old food traditions, and he has all kinds of arcane knowledge. He told me, for instance, you know, people say the French used to call the English les roast beef. Uh-huh. And everyone assumes it's because they ate roast beef. Heston said, no, it's not that. It's because it was English cooks who taught the French how to roast whole meat, whole cows and things. Uh-huh. That this was an art that was developed in England and it was unknown in France. So that's why, according to him, they call them the roast beefs.
And the English in return called the French the frog eaters, was it?
Yeah, well, of course, yeah, or frogs, yeah, exactly.
The funny thing is we just interviewed just a few days ago, is it Richard Bertinet, who's a French baker, and he claims with some justification, and even Prince Charles agreed with him, that he actually taught the English how to make bread again, which they had lost the art of doing.
And so did Raymond Blanc
swore that he single-handedly rescued British cuisine in the 1970s. I'm sure there's some truth to that one as well.
Yeah, there is, I'm sure.
We have a perspective on this since we've been going for such a long time.
Right.
And I remember the first time I was a student in Italy and I went to England, I lost 12 pounds in 2 weeks. The food was so bad.
And then we
have an article actually on our website, on themenuradio.com, if you go to OTM in print, it traces this whole development all of a sudden of the new English cuisine. Interesting that you touch on this too. At a certain period of time when the English started to pay attention to foods again, particularly in restaurants, it was all French.
All right. Exactly. As late as the 1950s or 60s, if you looked through restaurant guides, most restaurants were written in French and they would have an English translation, but I would say the majority of the better restaurants, 75% probably, had menus written in French, and the rest were miscellaneous ethnic, Indian of course, Greek restaurants, the famous Hungarian restaurant or two in London and so forth, but French was really the language of the kitchen, and many of the great chefs in London have always been French. Escoffier worked in London, and Raymond Soyer, some of the most famous people cooking there were French.
One of the interesting things that's going on now, it's going on here in the United States as well, is instead of giving a dish a name or some clue in its name as to how it's fixed, the chef just sort of writes down a string of ingredients, and you have to wait until the plate arrives at the table to figure out what he did with them. But here's where I'm going with this. The interesting thing is, a lot of these dishes that you have in your book, they're doing very much the same thing, except they have a funny name to start off with.
Yeah, why do they all do this?
Exactly.
I'm looking at this one.
Like cockaliki, for example, which says
cockaliki, rumbledy thumps, eaten mess.
How about Cullen skink? What is a skink?
Cullen skink. Well, Cullen skink, that's an interesting name. That's like, it's equivalent in a way to Welsh rarebit. And as you know, Welsh rarebit was originally Welsh rabbit. Mm-hmm. And the idea supposedly was either that the Welsh were such lousy hunters they couldn't actually shoot a rabbit, or
they were so poor.
So instead of having rabbit for supper, they'd have melted cheese. And Cullen skink, Cullen is a fishing town in Scotland, and a skink is a pork shank, a cured pork shank.
Really?
And so instead of, they didn't have the pigs, they didn't have the pork, so they made something with smoked seafood or cured seafood instead. So it was the Cullen, the town of Cullen's version of a meat dish, but it's made with smoked fish.
It's so funny. It was absolutely necessary for you to have a recipe for mushy peas?
Oh, it was, absolutely. I have baked beans, too, although those are two things that are arguably better right out of the can. I don't know.
Well, you know, that was interesting because I didn't know this about, we have our brother-in-law is convinced that Peter caused his heart attack because he took him out for a full English.
It was a lunch.
Oh, well,
it was a lunch, but it was like a full English cubed, or at the very least squared.
But I had to stop Peter cooking full English for our son when he was little. Because explain what full English is.
Well, a full English, or it's ultimately, or alternately called a full Scottish or a full Welsh or whatever, you are, but it's a huge, huge breakfast, basically, that involves, there's some variation, but it basically, the standards are some kind of sausage, bangers generally, black pudding, which is blood sausage, bacon being the English style of bacon,
so much better than American bacon,
leaner and then there's regional additions to the meat part, but those are the basics with the meat, and then there's eggs, usually fried, but it can be cooked other ways. There's generally bread that's fried in the bacon fat.
Yes, exactly. You got to do that.
And often baked beans on the side sometimes, and then tomatoes and mushrooms, which are fried. And regional variations. In Scotland, you might get haggis with it. Mm-hmm. In other places, in Ireland, you get generally two kinds. You get black pudding and you get what they call white pudding, which is a white sausage.
Right.
It's probably, I don't know if anyone, I'm sure people have computed the cholesterol count and the calories in it, but it's huge.
About 2,500, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's
got to be at least. And potatoes, too. They're often, especially in Ireland, of course, there'll always be little fried potato cakes or cubes. But it's really, today, it exists everywhere still. It's very common. But a lot of people eat it for lunch instead of breakfast, or a lot of people will eat a modified version of it. They won't have quite everything. They'll cut it down. But the full English is really, you have to be a very serious eater to dispatch one of those.
We'll do this 3 or 4 days in a row, and I just kept staring at him and see when he collapses.
Bravo.
She's watching me.
Peter also explained to me, because I did know some part of this book, as much as I know England, parts of it seem like they're written in a different language. I had no idea what a smoky was until he told me.
Uh-huh. Yeah, smokies are wonderful, and they're very subtle. They're not as strongly flavored as kippers, for instance.
Right.
I have a hard time with kippers, to tell you the truth.
now there is,
at that hour of the day.
there may be more than one dish that's missing, although I find it hard to believe that. There could only be one, since it's such a magnificent effort. But you are missing cabinet pudding.
Cabinet pudding, right.
Cabinet pudding was served in my college dining hall every Sunday. And it was composed of all the leftover sponge puddings from the week past, solidified into a reasonably solid block with custard. And then the most disgusting fruit sauce poured over the top of it.
Yes. Well, perhaps I considered it and decided not to include it. You know, you ever think of that? I actually did not consider it.
The interesting thing is that there is a historical reason for its name, and this is the more fascinating thing. And I'll bet there are a couple more that you can mention in your book. It turns out that in 1812, William Pitt the Younger had died as Prime Minister at age 35, partly as a result of the fact that he used to drink 3 bottles of port after dinner every day. And Lord Liverpool took over from him in 1812, and he was a minor figure in the House of Lords. So he said, I will take over the Parliament, but I will name all the people who I know are experts in their various fields to form my cabinet. Mm-hmm. And it was the first existence of cabinet government.
Oh, really?
And so the cabinet government was a collection of all the talents in the field of politics and diplomacy Right. And cabinet pudding a la St. Catherine's College was supposedly the same thing for all the desserts of the week mashed up together.
Oh, my God. I had no idea.
Now, you know, you had a lot of funny material to work from.
Do you have a couple more of that you can think of which have a sort of a curious
Hindle
connection?
Wakes. Hindle Wakes is pretty good.
Okay, go ahead.
Hindle Wakes.
You may not remember.
Hindle Wakes is kind of mysterious. It's much better than it sounds. If I describe it and I say that it's basically, it's a chicken that's cooked with prunes and a lemon sauce. And
sounds very strange to me.
there's actually another recipe in my book that combines chicken and prunes, and that's kakaliki, the famous Scottish soup.
Sure.
But Hindle Wakes is a strange, there's a strange story behind it, because the earliest recipe that I've been able to find, and I think anyone has been able to find, comes from a book published in 1932. And in that book, it's a fairly simple, recipe, but the, name of it is identical to the name of a play that was very popular, originally, the early 20th century. And it's a play that has been filmed like five times, most recently in by Laurence Olivier as a television show in 1976.
Really?
But it was a play that was the story of a factory girl who fell in love with the son of the owner of the factory, and she has basically a dirty weekend with him over a holiday weekend. And then he expects that he should do the right thing and marry her, but she says, no, that's okay, and she's not interested, and she runs off. So it's kind of an early feminist thing in a way. Mm-hmm. And a wake in the old sense was not necessarily a party after a funeral, but was a regional or village festival of some kind. And there's no town called Hindle, but the playwright made up the name Hindle Wakes, and it was about the weekend festival in Hindle. Mm-hmm. He was from Manchester, and there's a town near Manchester called Hindley, which may have been his inspiration. Mm-hmm. But then along comes a writer who wrote a book in 1954, a book called Food in England, which was very well received. And she claims that this is an ancient dish and that it was brought in by the Flemish weavers who were imported to England.
Oh, right. You wrote that in this book. Yeah, it's in there.
Yeah. And that Hindle Wakes was a corruption of hen, as in a chicken, de la wake, which is pretty silly because first of all, why would the Flemish who don't speak French say de la, which is a French construction, and why would they combine another language and English to describe a dish? And it seems to be a completely made up origin story.
Okay.
But it's a good dish, and believe it or not, it's basically a steamed chicken, which is stuffed with prunes and has lemon sauce, and it's surprisingly good.
Sounds like a surprise.
You know, I don't want to ask
exactly.
I don't want to ask you what's in Clapshot.
there's a story
for everything in here. And I want to say that you have such a great wit about you that I mean everything is intriguing in this book, and this is the kind of thing you can sit down and read even if you're not going to cook from it. And if you want to cook from it, you can get probably the greatest Yorkshire pudding recipe of all time.
Very simple, and so forth, and
with a lot of humor too, like the duck that tastes like fish, among other things. And you explain tea and high tea and all that with this book. So
Coleman is
great.
You have tongue firmly planted in cheek. I just know.
Oh, yeah,
I just know you do. But I think my country came off rather well, and
I think it did too. I hope it did.
I think it was in good hands, and I can't wait. This one's a keeper. I'm going to keep it at my bedside in case I wake up hungry.
It's going to be a great holiday gift, too. The British Table by Coleman Andrews. So good talking to you again, Coleman.
Thank you very much. Great to talk to you.
Don't forget to tune in next week when you'll hear
the start of our interviews.
First-hand report from...
Yeah. From the stove front.
Yeah, there you go. The stove front report from the City of London. Much maligned.
I'm really excited.
Now much celebrated. And we'll tell you why you should celebrate it and why you should go and why you should join us again. Same time, same place next week. And until then...
Bye-bye.